Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the program. My name is William Hemsworth. It's great to be with you all again for today's program. Honored to have my guest. He's the author of a great book titled Killing Atheism. And Kenneth L. Fredrickson is a retired corporate and securities attorney, a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of the University of California, Berkeley. And he has a couple other writings that are soon to be published called Praying to and with Mary, A Layman's Guide to Guide and Understand. Ken, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing fine, and thank you for having me on board.
My absolute pleasure. To have you on the program to talk about this great topic that you wrote about, Killing Atheism. Before I get into questions about the book, can you maybe tell us a little bit about yourself?
I sure can. Let me just start a little bit with my academic background. You mentioned it as we on the introduction, but I am a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley, a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania Law School. I was fortunate enough to, upon graduation, go and work for a prominent Wall Street law firm, worked there for a few years, then went off and became generally in-house counsel for some companies, and retired, after about 30 years of doing that. And what prompted me to write this book, of course, was the fact that I don't think traditional apologetics work. I think what we need is evidence. And as I started getting into the review of the evidence that's out there, it just became more and more apparent to me that this is being largely overlooked. And fortunately, my background, I think, in securities law and tax law and corporate law just kind of gave me the background and the ability to take complex issues and unravel them and put them back together again in understandable form. So that's my background there in terms of academics and work history. In terms of my religious history, if we want to call it that, I was born into a Mormon family. I grew up on a farm in upstate New York. As I said, I grew up born into a Mormon family, mm-hmm. kind of migrated away from that. It just didn't make a lot of sense to me, particularly after I wrote a book by Fawn Brody called No Man Knows My History, which I would recommend to anyone. It's been out for years and years and years now, but it's just a phenomenal book. It's unlike many books which discuss Mormonism. It's not emotionally charged, just doesn't attack the people in the church and the church itself. It just lays it out, evidence. And I thought that was what was so important was evidence, stuff that can be empirically confirmed. So as a result, when I went into the Air Force, I became a navigator in the Air Force. They asked me what religion I wanted to put on my dog tags. And I said, Christian. And they said, well, wait a minute. No, you can't do that. Are you Lutheran? What are you, Catholic? Right. No, I'm a Christian. Well, that took a little bit of convincing, but nevertheless, they put it on my dog tags that I was Christian, whatever that was, in terms of they needed to have a specific denomination, but of course it wasn't there. So I was born into the Mormon family. I migrated to a generic Christian faith, and I was fortunate enough to marry a wonderful girl of Irish descent, and we've had a fantastic marriage for a number of years. I've got three great sons and four great grandchildren and two wonderful daughters-in-law. So we've been very, very fortunate. But over the years, I began to realize how important and how true the Catholic Church was. And so I converted to that and have been a Catholic, of course, now for many, many years. And the upshot of it is my oldest son is Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox.
Okay.
My youngest son is a very strong Catholic. My middle son, well, I'm not quite sure of exactly where he's shaking out at the present time, but he's going to be okay. And other members of my extended family, they're Seventh-day Adventists, they're all kinds of different people out there. So it's really nice to have that background of a diverse background of from folks that you intimate with, and they can kind of feed you and you can understand where they're coming from. So as a result, in the book itself, although I think it inevitably leads to the Catholic position, I try to make it non-denominational. I certainly don't attack any other faiths, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. At least I don't intend to. And but as I think, as you go through the evidence, particularly the Marian apparitions, I just find it difficult to believe how you could come to any other conclusion but that the church, the Catholic Church, is the church on earth that most closely approximates the fullness of the gospel. So that's where I am. I know the world's got plenty of theologians and folks like that to tell us what we ought to believe. But when they start getting into the traditional apologetics, quite frankly, I get lost. I just don't understand so much of what they're talking about. Number one, and number two, for every argument on either side, there's a counter argument. And the result is you got 500 years or 1,000 or 2,000 years of going back and forth, and no one really seems to convince the other guy. I mean, obviously that's not 100% true, but but people tend to get kind of wrapped up in their own position. And when they argue apologetics, they tend to just go off and listen, just argue the points that favor them. So I'm trying to get around that just by presenting evidence. It's not a book on theology. It's a book on evidence.
I love your background. I was in the Army myself and I was a chaplain assistant.
Oh, wow.
And so when you talk about the different denominations, we used to get a report every couple months of the new soldiers in the unit. And it like I said, it broke it down by denomination. So yeah, you brought up a lot of memories with that story. Cause you had to try to accommodate them all in some fashion. So sometimes it was very challenging.
Oh, wow. I'll bet. Yeah.
But your book, it came out in January and you've gone over a little bit of why you decided to write it, but why was January the right time to maybe get it out into the world?
Oh, it wasn't.
Okay.
It's just that's a timetable and everything is determined by the publisher. And it just took a while for it to get out. That's all. I would have preferred it to have come out in, say, November or something like that.
Okay.
But I had no control over that.
But now, the first chapter, you give four primary reasons on why someone may reject God. Can you go into those a little bit?
Yes, I can. I think, of course, one of the reasons is that the existence of pain, suffering, and evil, and people just say, well, if there's a loving God, why on earth would he permit all of this stuff that's going on? And in fact, Bishop Barron said that he finds that to be the single most challenging issue that he has to deal with. Although I think once you really consider pain, evil, and suffering, and look at it in the context of where we're going and God's creative process, I think it's not all that. It shouldn't be all that off-putting. But that's one reason. And the second reason, of course, and really the main reason is the feeling that there's a hidden God. If he's there, why doesn't he reveal himself? Why doesn't he show himself? What's the big secret? And of course he does, but you have to be aware of that. You have to look for it, and you don't have to look too hard. I think you have to put your pride behind you. And I think you have to say, okay, God, if you're there, where are you? And by gosh, once you start doing that, you can start seeing the phenomenal thing called Fatima and the miracle of the sun and all of these other, all of these other miraculous events and visitations that have taken place. Another reason, of course, is that the perception of the atheists and agnostics is that the Bible is essentially either a work of fiction or it's certainly untrustworthy. They take the position that it was written decades after the so-called events occurred. It's a made-up story. And I hope to show it in my book that can't possibly be the case. And particularly, and all of these other reasons other than the hidden God are really what I call a subordinate reasons, because once you see that there is the strong evidence of God, well, okay, now if you don't like evil and suffering, which nobody does, really what you're saying is, okay, maybe there's a God, but he just didn't do it right. He didn't create the world properly. I would have done it differently, that type of thing. And of course, the other reason why people don't accept the Christianity, or we call it Christianity because that's what I'm talking about, but they do not accept Christianity is because they maintain that science has got all the answers now. We've got evolution, we've got this, we got that, and that we don't no longer need the supernatural being, this sky daddy in the sky that takes care of everything for us. So I look upon those as the four major reasons why people just can't accept the gospel of the Lord.
Okay. And you've elaborated on this idea of traditional apologetics already, but you go into depth in chapter two about the futility of traditional apologetics. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more for us?
Well, I'll try to. All I know is that, excuse me, there are just countless books and websites and articles about from people just trying to prove or disprove the theory trying to prove or disprove Christianity. And I go back to when Christ walked the earth, when Jesus walked the earth. He didn't walk around talking about epistemology. He didn't talk around talking about, he didn't anticipate St. Aquinas' five proofs. He didn't do all of that. All he did was just talk to the people, and he would perform miracles and miracles and miracles, one after another. And beginning right at Cana, when he turned the water into wine at the request of his mother. And I think, and the other thing is the transfiguration is just absolutely incredible. And the disciples began to see more and more that this was the divine Son of God. And he did that by proving miracle after miracle. And then, of course, the ultimate of all miracles was his death and passion and death on the cross and his resurrection. So I just think that a traditional apologetics is good as far as it goes. It gets you into the door, I think. But I think it's if your belief is based on strictly on apologetics, my belief is that it's a tenuous belief. It's a belief that can be unraveled when things start going wrong. And you just have to. That's an entry into the doorway. But to get into the doorway and to stay there, you need to have, first of all, you need to have a desire to get in. You have to have a desire to enter the Christian mansion. And if you don't have that, you will ignore all the evidence. You will ignore Fatima. You will ignore the Lady of China. You won't even have heard about the Lady of China. All of these things. Because you get back to your arguments that the Dawkins of the world have propounded. You say, well, that makes sense to me. And then you go off and into your own world. So apologetics, I think, is good for, and it's probably conclusive for some people, but I think for most people, it's not. I think for most people, it'll get you there, but in order to get there and stay there, you need to have prayer and you need to have more prayer. And if prayer doesn't work at first, you just kind of do what a lot of folks did when they want to perfect something. You just practice. And by gosh, I will tell you, it happens. It really is incredible. And so the other thing is that so many people think that, well, if you're a Christian, then you're a Neanderthal, you're stupid, you're this and you're that. But here's the thing is that when you look at the people that believe or disbelieve or don't know, the people that you got people of highly intelligence in right. All three categories. So it's just so much of it just depends on where you want to go. And if you want to believe, then you have to have something to lay that belief on. And I think it's evidence. Okay. But that's just the attorney in me talking.
Well, and some of the greatest thinkers throughout history, last 2,000 years, have actually been Christians too. So, but yeah, evidence does play a big role. Now, you mentioned a couple things already. You mentioned Fatima, Our Lady of China. And your book, you dedicate a lot of time to the various Marian apparitions.
Right.
So how are they proof? Can you tell us how they're proof for God? Maybe how someone could look at them and see it as evidence.
Well, let's begin with Fatima, of course. And I think there's incredible evidence for Fatima and the miracle of the sun. It's conclusive. Any way you look at it is absolutely conclusive because of the miracles that took place beginning And incidentally, if the Our Lady of Fatima was Mary, the mother of our Lord, well, you know what? That's 100% proof right there of the God of Christian theology. I mean, there's no, you can't depart from that.
Right.
You just can't say, well, okay, she appeared, but that doesn't prove anything. Boy, it proves everything. It proves that she's the mother of the Lord. It proves at Lourdes, where she said that she was the Immaculate Conception. It proves where in Fatima, when she said, I am the Lady of the Rosary. So the proof is just, once you've established the proof, there can be no conclusion other than this was the mother of our Lord. Now, the evangelicals will say, well, no, this was the devil speaking in disguise. Well, I don't really get into that in a lot of detail in the book, because my book is aimed towards people that just don't believe in God or having a hard time with their faith. My next book, Praying to Mary, How to Understand and Defend, I get into that in a lot more detail. But I like to look upon Fatima, for instance, as they got four incredible proofs. Number one, the three Fatima children said, beginning on July 13th, that on October 13th at noon at the Cova da Areia in Portugal, that a specific site, a specific time, a specific place, that there was going to be a miracle, that Our Lady was going to effect a miracle. They said that. I mean, they didn't hesitate. They said, that's what they're going to do. And guess what? On 12 noon, on October 13th, at the place located, there was this incredible miracle called the miracle of the sun.
Right.
I mean, that right there should be a pretty strong sign that we're talking the real McCoy here. And the second thing is that the miracle of the sun itself, just the way it occurred, and it's absolutely staggering how the way that the sun behaved. And the most important thing, which is often bypassed and overlooked by those that attack the miracle, or even those that believe in it, is what the sun did in terms of how the perception of the people that were there, how it just came crashing down. It was coming down upon the earth. It was just getting closer and closer, and people were just absolutely terrified. People were running. Hardcore atheists were on their knees suddenly praying. Another part of the function of the element of the miracle was it had been raining all the night before, and in the morning everything was drenched. The people were drenched. They had been there for hours. The cova itself, where the miracle occurred, or were centered, where the children spoke with Mary, it's in a form of a huge amphitheater kind of thing. It's a big depression, like from the bottom of it to the top. It's 18 feet, and they're of course at the bottom. So when it rained and rained and rained, there was different levels of moisture and water on the ground, and everyone said, even those that were in like a puddle of water, said that following the miracle, everything was instantly dried. It was just dry. Now, okay. I'm trying to figure some natural causes for that.
Right.
Some folks come back and they say, well, how do we know it rained? It didn't rain that much. Well, it did. There's all kinds of newspaper reports of how it rained. And the atheists that were there said, yeah, it was really raining. And then all of a sudden, everything was dry. Another miracle that took place, which was on September 13th, that people, most people just don't know about. And that is at the time when Mary was to appear at the site. By this time, the word had gone out that there were thousands and thousands of people there. They knew that she appeared every 13th of the month. And there she was. They were waiting to see what was going to happen. Well, here's the upshot. They say that nobody ever saw Mary until, except the three children, which is true. But here's what thousands of people did see. They saw coming down from the sky, traveling east to west, this luminous globe. It sounds like something out of a fiction, but they just saw this luminous globe come down, and it stayed, and it came down over where the children were and then disappeared. And then there was some smoke that would arise, or not smoke, but appearance of smoke from the spot that she was. And then after a short time, as she finished her visitation, the globe appeared and off it went again back to the east. Now, this is incredible. Now, this shows that something, this shows a heavenly visit, and a heavenly visit can only mean one thing, and that's God. And it can only mean one thing, that's the Christian God, because that's Mary, that's who Mary was. So those are just incredible. And then the other thing is that people don't understand is that at Fatima, and I spent a lot of time at Fatima because that's the miracle that's known most widely, but people don't realize is that in their four previous visitations to the children, beginning June 13th, and she started her visitations on May 13th, but by that time a month had elapsed, other people knew about it. So beginning June 13th, people started to show up and be there, and they just witnessed all kinds of spectacular signs that the changes in the atmosphere, sometimes the scar, the atmosphere would dim. All of these things took place through the observations of other people, not the children.
Yeah, and you like I said, you cover a lot of them in the book, a lot more than Fatima. But the cool thing about Fatima too is that we have newspaper clippings about it too. So
exactly, yes, yeah. And what's interesting is I asked one guy, I said, well, how do you explain the fact that the three children were able to prophesy? I mean, they were talking about kids ages 10, 9, and 7 or 8, right. Yeah, 7.
Young ones, yeah.
Yeah, young. How did they prophesy what was going to happen? Well, people make predictions all the time, and they just got lucky. And one of them said, another one said, well, I would have been more impressed if they had said what the miracle was going to be. So there you go. How do you deal with that?
Just someone who doesn't want to believe it, I guess, mm-hmm. at all. Now, in chapter 7, though, you discuss the dilemma of the incomprehensible God, mm-hmm. and that being an excuse. Can you give our listeners and viewers maybe an idea of what that whole objection's about?
Well, I guess you could start with the first cause issue, and that is, people say that, theologians say, well, you know, every action has a predecessor action, which is a cause and effect back thing, which means that if you go back and back and back in time, there has to be a first cause. There has to be something that started something, but there was nothing. So how can there be anything but God? The atheists or agnostics respond by saying, well, then how do you explain God? Because he came from nothing. And you try to explain why that could be. And you can't, of course, because it's way beyond our comprehension. And I thought that the best answers, I think I mentioned this in the book, came from an 11-year-old boy and said, what's the problem? God is God. I mean, you're talking about an entirely different level.
Right.
Something is entirely different. And it's beyond comprehension, but to say, I mean, how, you know, when you think about it, how could you possibly comprehend God? I mean, we are really talking in terms of something that's just phenomenally different.
Well, I believe it was Saint Augustine who said, if you fully understand him, he's not God.
Exactly right. Exactly. And that's another story about Saint Augustine. Emphasizes the point that you just said. He had a vision, or it was a vision, or maybe it actually happened, I'm not sure. But he had spent 30 years trying to explain the Trinity, trying to develop a theory to explain the Trinity. And he just was just wrestling with it and wrestling with it. And he was walking on the beach one day, and he came across this little boy who had a seashell, and he was digging a hole in the sand. And then he would go over to the ocean, fill up the seashell with some of the ocean water, and take it, drop it into the hole. And St. Augustine said, what are you doing? He said, I'm emptying out the ocean. And he said, don't be silly. You can't empty out the ocean into that little hole. And the little boy turned to him and said, well, guess what? You can't explain the Trinity. My ability and likelihood of my emptying the ocean into this hole is far greater than your ability or probability of your being able to explain the Trinity. So I thought that's just kind of explained everything. And that's why St. Augustine is associated with seashells.
Yeah, and he spent 16 years writing his book on the Trinity.
Yeah.
So it's amazing.
Incredible.
One last question. Well, a couple more questions on the book, but I'm going to jump ahead a little bit to chapter 17. And you talk about the body and its complexity. And I think you did a really good job on discussing it as proof. But for the benefit of our listeners, how is the body and its complexity like proof of God, proof of Jesus?
It's just absolutely, you know, as I point to two examples in the book, the ear and the eye. And particularly, I go with the ear because there's a lot of discussion about the eyes and how, well, gradually, you know, it just developed because there was a spot on a piece of the skin and it became more sensitive to light. But if you look at the ear and the complexity of the ear and all the intricate parts that are part of it, then you have to have the conduit which leads to the brain, which transfers that information to the brain. And then you have the brain itself, which has to interpret that. All of these elements of the audio system cannot develop by themselves. There's no reason to. There's no advantage. There's no survival advantage until the whole thing is complete and put together in one step. How does that happen? And then you look at, there's some really incredible videos out there in terms of the cell and the complexity of each cell and the little machines in each cell. Each cell is so different, and yet they all weave together in a phenomenal mosaic that just bring that. I'm sorry, you could talk about evolution, but evolution, when you think about it, is just a word. And that's all it is. It's a word which says at different times, at different places, there are different life forms. Okay, we can accept that. I think that's pretty clear. But how can you explain how the complexity of the body, all of the 10 or 11 human body systems, each one complex in itself, cannot stand by itself. It has to have the other ones around it developing, coming together simultaneously in order for it to make any sense, in order for it to survive. It just can't happen. And that point is so ignored all the time. It just boggles my mind.
And also in that chapter, you have some great diagrams to explain even more deeper exactly what you're talking about just now. So what feedback have you received from the book? It's been out since January now, but what feedback have you received?
Very little. I hate to say it, but I just has not been, I'm trying to get it out there and it gets buried with all of the other books that are printed. It was a little bit discouraging because I've tried to bring it to various churches and all that. And I run into the problem. I think this is the problem. Evangelicals and non-Catholic Christians don't want to talk about it because of its references to Mary. Whenever you talk about Mary, they just this curtain just falls down in front of them. They don't want to talk about it. I hate to say this, but when I go to the Catholic clergy and those folks, you know, they say, well, that's nice. But I got to tell you, I think they feel that their turf is being invaded upon. Maybe not, and I may be a little bit cynical on this, but I think they say, well, look, I've gone all these years of theology. I've got my this degree and that degree. And who are you to tell me how I should present the facts? That's just my opinion. I'm not saying that's the case, but that's just the feel. And I can understand that because I spent years as security lawyers. And as a securities lawyer and a corporate law lawyer, and if I were to walk down the street, some guy came up to me, a layman, and started telling me about securities law, I would just tell him to go take a hike because he's got to, you know, he just doesn't have the background for that. Mm-hmm. So I think now one really positive response I got was from a Protestant reader who said, this book is so full of love and it explains things the way I've never heard it explained before. So that was really, really encouraging. So I'm still waiting for more feedback. Maybe some of your listeners could do that.
Oh, definitely. Now, where can our listeners, where can they get the book?
Oh, any place, Amazon. In fact, if you just go to Amazon and just You know, type in at the top there under books, just write Killing Atheism. It'll pop up.
Pops right up. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And if anyone does buy it, and I encourage to do this, any book that you buy, when you buy a book, please leave a review. It's amazing how far that goes to get the word out about the book.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So Ken, where can our listeners maybe reach you if they have any questions or anything?
Well, they can reach me at my email, and I don't mind giving that. It's Fredrickson01@msn.com.
Okay.
It's Fredrickson01. 01@msn.com.
Again, the book is Killing Atheism. And Ken, I appreciate your time today. Just come on to give us a little bit of knowledge about your book. I really appreciate it.
Well, listen, I really appreciate you coming on and getting the word out, because there's so many people out there I know that are struggling with their faith. And hopefully, if I could just get one person back on board into the Christian mansion again, then my book will have been worth it.
Amen. Amen. Well, take care, Ken. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.